those bifurcations and go to the fold hop bifurcation on transparency 47 or slide 47. Okay, so this is a new bifurcation. This is a local bifurcation. Okay, so we recognize it from the eigenvalues. And let me just prepare you a little bit for what we're going to do. So remember how we recognize bifurcations. At a saddle node bifurcation, a real eigenvalue goes to zero. At a hop bifurcation, we have a pair of complex conjugate eigenvalues and the real part goes to zero. Okay, those are codimension 1 bifurcations. At a codimension 2 bifurcation, something else happens. And we need another parameter to find it. Because two unusual things have to happen at once. Okay? So for instance, at a Tokens-Bogdanoff bifurcation, 2 eigenvalues have to be zero. It's a double zero bifurcation. Lambda 1 is equal to 0 and lambda 2 is equal to 0. So two things have to be satisfied at once. We need two parameters to find Tokens-Bogdanoff bifurcation. Okay? Now, there are a couple of other relatively simple local codimension 2 bifurcations. Because what else interesting could happen with eigenvalues? Well, the next interesting thing could be that a real eigenvalue is equal to zero. Okay, so we're at a saddle node, and there's a pair of complex conjugate eigenvalues with real part equal to zero. Okay, that's a second condition, and that would be a codimension 2 bifurcation, where a saddle node comes together, that's the real eigenvalue equal to zero, and a hop comes together, where the real part is equal to zero, but the imaginary part is not equal to zero. Okay, so this is very similar to a Tokens-Bogdanoff bifurcation, but it's not the same thing. And don't be fooled. They look alike in some ways, but they're very, very different. And this is sometimes called a fold-hop bifurcation for obvious reasons. You're on a fold line with a real eigenvalue equal to zero, and you're on a hop bifurcation with a real part equal to zero. Also called a Gavrilov-Guggenheimer bifurcation, I guess, for the mathematicians who first studied this seriously and started proving theorems about it. Okay? So we're going to talk about this bifurcation. It's an interesting bifurcation. It's a challenging bifurcation. And it's good practice for doing this sort of thing. But I have to warn you, I think I've only seen it once, fleetingly, in a model that Andrea Ciliberto and I were working on. I'm pretty sure that this bifurcation was there, but we kind of lost interest in the model because it wasn't a very good model. It wasn't a very successful model. But for a while, we were really interested in it because it had this bifurcation. But otherwise, you know, I've never published a paper with a model that has this bifurcation. But it happens, and it's going to happen someday, and it's really cool. So we ought to learn about it and learn to recognize it so we'll know it when it shows up. Okay? Now you can keep playing this game, and in the bifurcation textbooks, the next section, well, what will the next kind of local codimension 2 bifurcation be? If you see how we play this game, right? Codimension 1 is like a real eigenvalue of 0 or a pair of complex conjugate with a real part equals 0. Okay? Codimension 2, 2 real eigenvalues equal to 0. Or codimension 2, 1 real eigenvalue equals 0 and a complex conjugate with real part equals 0. Okay, what's the next one to look for? 2 pairs of complex conjugate eigenvalues with the real parts equal to 0. Okay? And that's called a hop-hop bifurcation, a double hop bifurcation, or maybe it has some names associated with it, okay? That's the next one to do. We're not going to do it. I've never seen it. It's hard to do. It's in the textbooks. If you're interested, learn it on your own. I wash my hands of this after the fold-hop bifurcation. Okay, but it's going to take us probably, I mean, I'm only going to get started on this lecture. It'll certainly take us one more lecture to go through fold-hop bifurcation. Then I may come back and visit some of these non-local codimension 2 bifurcations that are important because you see them all the time. And then we'll quit. Okay? So we'll be done maybe by Thanksgiving or maybe just right at the end of the semester. Okay? Good timing. So, the fold-hop bifurcation. Slide 47. The conditions that we are at a fold-hop bifurcation are, first of all, we have to be at a steady state. So we have n nonlinear algebraic equations, f of x and p equal to 0, because we're at a steady state. Okay? And then we have another condition. So the n plus first condition is that a real eigenvalue be equal to 0. And then the n plus 2 second condition is that the real part of a pair of complex conjugate eigenvalues be equal to 0. Okay? So we have n plus 2 equations in your unknowns or your n variables, the x sub 1s or x sub n, and you have a whole bunch of parameters. So now this this becomes a codimension 2 bifurcation problem because I'm going to have to have freedom to adjust two parameters to find to satisfy all these conditions. And that'll give me this codimension 2 point. Now, how do we try to understand what it looks like? So I've tried to draw here what a two parameter fold looks like. Okay? So my two parameters are P1 and P2 plotted on the plane. And the third direction I've used to do one of my variables, say the first variable, x sub 1. And typically what a fold looks like is this surface. I'm plotting my steady state value of one of my variables as a function of the two parameters. And what I see is a sheet, and that sheet has a fold in it. And the fold line, where the sheet is folded, the fold line is where a real eigenvalue is equal to 0. It's where two steady states are coming together and annihilating each other at the fold line. And that's where a real eigenvalue is equal to 0. And if I project the fold line down onto the two-parameter plane, I'll find a curve. That's a curve of, generally speaking, saddle node bifurcations, where lambda 1 is equal to 0. Okay? So now you imagine this fold line where some steady states are coming together and annihilating each other. Meanwhile, away from the fold line, we're following a pair of complex conjugate eigenvalues. Okay? So on the upper surface of this fold, maybe I have an attractor. It looks like an attractor, but there's a locus of Hopf bifurcations. That's possible, right? Where the attracting steady state becomes a repeller because a pair of complex conjugate eigenvalues crosses the imaginary axis. And there's a Hopf bifurcation there. And as I follow that Hopf bifurcation, it comes over to the fold. And it essentially just follows across the fold and goes onto the lower surface of steady states. And it's still a Hopf bifurcation on the lower surface of steady states. Now, some of these are saddle points, but there's no reason why a saddle point can't also undergo a Hopf bifurcation. It'll definitely be unstable limit cycles because the saddle point itself is unstable. But it can undergo this Hopf bifurcation. Okay? Now look, this And if I project it down onto the two-parameter plane in the lower right-hand corner, what I see is a locus of saddle nodes, and I'm following the hop bifurcation. It looks like a perfectly reasonable hop bifurcation on the upper surface, and I follow it. It comes into the saddle node tangentially. Looks like a Takens-Bogdanoff bifurcation, but it isn't, because it just goes right onto the lower sheet and follows along on the lower sheet, and it's still Hopf bifurcations. Okay? And what's the big difference between this and a Takens-Bogdanoff bifurcation? The period of the limit cycle remains finite. As you're following these limit cycles close to this Hopf bifurcation, the period doesn't go to infinity. And it just slips over onto the other sheet of the fold, and there's still limit cycles coming off these Hopf bifurcations, because the imaginary part's not going to zero. Okay? But the question is, what does happen? Okay, what does this look like, and what are the dynamical consequences of this kind of behavior? Okay. So, yeah, in the bifurcation diagram, there are four regions, right? So the bifurcation point is where these curves are just touching each other. And that's a codimension 2 bifurcation. I need to adjust the two parameters to get to the bifurcation point. And then what I'm drawing here is what's called the unfolding of the codimension 2 bifurcation. What happens around that codimension 2 bifurcation? And there are four different regions, and we have to characterize what the phase portraits look like in these four different regions so that we'll be able to recognize a fold-hop bifurcation, and also know what the dynamical consequences are going to be in the neighborhood of a fold-hop bifurcation. Okay. Now, what makes this complicated is that up until now, I've been able to illustrate all these bifurcations with a two-dimensional phase space. I've only needed two variables to basically show you what the dynamics looks like around these bifurcations. But the fold-hop bifurcation requires a minimum of three variables, because I got to track three different eigenvalues: a real eigenvalue, which is going through zero, and a pair of complex conjugate eigenvalues. And I can only get that if I have at least three variables in the system. So you'll only find this bifurcation in systems of a minimum of three variables that are all interacting with each other and doing something interesting. Okay? So we need a three-dimensional phase space to characterize the phase portraits, but that's very uncomfortable to try to draw three-dimensional phase spaces. But we use a trick, because In the vicinity of this bifurcation, remember what's happening in the vicinity, there's a real eigenvalue that's going to zero. So there's a dimension in which you get a critical slowing down in one dimension. Okay? And in the other two dimensions, we have a rotation, because there's a complex conjugate eigenvalue with an imaginary part that's not zero. And that imaginary part that's not zero drives a constant rotation around the direction where you're getting the critical slowing down. So it's very convenient to describe the system in a cylindrical coordinate system. We start with three variables, x1, x2, and x3, and we just do a change of variables such that x1 is the direction where the critical slowing down is occurring. Okay, so we put that right along the eigenvector that has the eigenvalue that's going to zero. And then, perpendicular to that direction is the direction where the hop bifurcation is happening. And for the hop bifurcation, we can go into a polar coordinate system where rho is the polar direction away from the steady state and phi is the angle at which we're rotating. And we don't have to worry about phi, because all phi does is turn round and round and round at a frequency omega, which is the imaginary part of the eigenvalue. What we're really concerned is what's happening to rho. In the polar direction, are things moving towards the x1 direction, because it's an attractor, or are they moving away because there's a limit cycle? Okay? So here's kind of the picture. What I'll always draw is x1 in the horizontal direction. That's the direction where the critical slowing down is going to happen. And I'll put rho in the vertical direction because it tells me how far away from x1 I am. And there's nothing in negative direction because this is a polar system. Rho is always positive. And then we just imagine in our head that what's happening as time proceeds is that the rho vector rotates around the x1 vector at a constant angular velocity. And I don't try to capture that. Okay? So for instance, a typical phase portrait might look like this one in the lower left. Here's the x1 direction where I have three steady states. One of them looks to be stable. The one on the left is a stable node because all the arrows are coming in. That's a stable node. Let me see. This is lacking some arrows. This is a completely unstable steady state, the white one, because all the arrows are going away. And this arrow coming out to the right should be going away from that white steady state. So that's a completely unstable steady state. All the eigenvalues have negative real parts. One of them is real and negative, and the other one is complex conjugate with negative real part. It moves away. Positive. They're all positive, right? Because they're all moving away. And then this steady state to the far right is also a stable node. All the eigenvalues are positive or negative that's coming into this steady state. Okay? I meant these arrows to come into this guy. I forgot to draw the arrowheads. So I want this one on the far right to be stable. This middle one's not a saddle. It's completely unstable. It's unstable in all directions. All the eigenvalues have positive real parts. There's a saddle, but the saddle is an unstable limit cycle. This guy here, which is off the x-axis, looks like a saddle, right? Because trajectories are coming in from the southeast and the northwest and then going out in a orthogonal direction, right? So that looks like a saddle point, but it's not a steady state because it's off the x-axis and there's a rotation. Okay? So this point is really an unstable limit cycle because of the rotation in the phi direction. So I'm trying to illustrate that. This is my standard picture in my polar coordinate system. The horizontal direction is the x1 direction. The vertical direction is the rho direction. And now I bring it over into x1, x2, x3 space, and what do I see? I see in the x1 direction, I see the three steady states. The one on the left is a stable steady state. The one on the right, far right, is a stable steady state. And the one in the middle is completely unstable. It's unstable in all directions. And this point here off the axis corresponds to the limit cycle, which is this closed trajectory right about here. That's a limit cycle. Okay? Because it doesn't change in the x1 direction, it doesn't change in the rho direction, but it's still spinning round and round. So it's a limit cycle, but it's an unstable limit cycle, because any small perturbation away from this limit cycle will increase. And you'll move away from the limit cycle either to the left and go to this stable steady state, or to the right and end up at this stable steady state. Okay? Right. So I want to, I have a three-dimensional dynamical system, which I can describe in a typical Cartesian coordinate system, which is this system. But I'm assuming that it has rotation symmetry. So it would be better to describe it in a polar coordinate system. And the nice thing about the polar coordinate system is I can suppress the rotation. There's no reason to represent the rotation. Just keep it in your head that it's all the time rotating. And what we're really interested in is just the dynamics in the x1 direction and the dynamics in the rho direction. Because the rho direction tells you whether you're contracting onto the x1 direction or moving away from the x1 direction. All the time spinning. So in particular, in the way I'm drawing this, on the left, I have a trajectory that comes out of the limit cycle. It looks like a trajectory that comes out of the limit cycle and comes into the stable steady state on the right. But of course, I mean, that's what it does. If I take out the phi motion, this is what it's going to do as a function of time. But if I put in the rotation, then what's happening, of course, I'm starting close to the unstable limit cycle, and as I rotate, the amplitude increases and I move to the left or to the right. I'm getting a little confused here. The amplitude increases, I'm rotating, I move to the right, and then the amplitude starts decreasing, and I just spiral down onto the stable steady state and end up here. So if you want to know what the motion is in the full three-dimensional space, you have to put the rotation back in. But you don't need it. Okay? Okay, so again, there's always a horizontal line. That's the x1 direction. And those are going to be real steady states. Because rho is equal to zero, and there's no rotation at rho equals zero. So things along the horizontal line are steady states. But what look like steady states off the horizontal line are really limit cycles, because of the rotation. And you can tell whether they're stable or unstable limit cycles by looking at what happens to them just in the x rho direction. It's now completely unstable. I'm going to show that'll show up in as we go through this. I'm just trying to teach you now how to read these diagrams. I didn't tell you this was going to be easy, right? This has to be a lot harder because we've got to keep track of three eigenvalues, three directions. But this is a really cute way to do it. Okay? Yes?
You mentioned that x1 direction is the critical one direction.
Yes? Well, that's what's going to happen when I'm close to the bifurcation. Right now, I'm not close to the bifurcation, right? I'm not close to the bifurcation, so nothing strange has happened here. This is completely generic. Now, when I get close to the bifurcation, I'm going to push these two together. And then I'm going to get a saddle node, and I'm going to get critical slowing down. Or I'm going to push the limit cycle down onto one of these steady states and get a hop bifurcation. And then things are going to get tricky. Okay? Well, okay, it's a three-variable system. I really need three dynamical variables to describe it. But it has a certain symmetry because I'm assuming that one eigenvalue is going to pass through zero and the other eigenvalue is going to be a complex conjugate pair. So close to the bifurcation, it's natural to move into a cylindrical coordinate system. Okay? Because I have there's one eigendirection associated with a real eigenvalue. That's what I'm going to call x1. That's my horizontal axis. So I just put it in that direction. And then the other two directions are associated with a pair of complex conjugate eigenvalues. That tells me I got a rotation. And I want to go into a polar coordinate system to describe that rotation. Okay? You know, now, of course, what mathematicians have to do, they got to do all the algebraic details, right? And do the transformation and prove the theorems. We don't have to worry about that. We only have to see the pictures, right? And we let them worry about the details. So let me just show a couple pictures from Kuznetsov's textbook to again, help you get the idea about what's going on here. The problem is he uses a different notation and a different... I don't know why he does this. What he calls C is what I call X1. And what he puts in the vertical direction, I put in the horizontal direction. I'm sorry about that. I don't know why we why we did that. But, you know, he's just trying to show you in this diagram on the top of slide 49 what I was just trying to describe, right? So here's the X1 direction, and here's this what looks like a steady state off the axis, but that's really the unstable limit cycle. And now you're doing a rotation around the Z direction, and you get the limit cycle. It's marked L. That's the limit cycle due to the rotation. And then these surfaces, WS and WU, they're the stable and unstable manifolds of the limit cycle. So this limit cycle is attracting along the stable manifold, W super S of L. That's the stable manifold, the attracting manifold of the limit cycle. And then there's another manifold, WU of L, which is the unstable manifold where the trajectories are moving away from the limit cycle. Okay? So that's what... These are the pictures we're going to draw, and this is what it means in the full three-dimensional space. You see why we don't try and keep track of what's happening in three dimensions. It's too complicated even to draw. But it's very easy to think about when you know how to read these diagrams on the left. Now, the tricky one is we're going to find that sometimes the limit cycle can undergo a torus bifurcation. And what happens when a limit cycle undergoes a torus bifurcation? Remember, there's a pair of Floquet multipliers that escape from the unit circle. And on our diagrams, it looks like we've created a limit cycle around the steady state. But remember, this steady state is a limit cycle to begin with. So this closed curve around that thing is actually, when you rotate everything around the vertical axis, is a donut. That's the torus. Okay? And this looks like this is a stable attractor, right? Because it's pulling things in. but it's really a stable torus. So there's a trajectory that's looping around on this torus. It's a almost periodic oscillation, probably never closes on itself, but it always stays on the torus. And it's an attracting torus. You can see that it's an attracting torus because the trajectories are pulling onto that torus. And inside the torus, the dashed line is the unstable limit cycle. And things are going away from the unstable limit cycle and being attracted to the torus. Okay, we have to quit. But, you know, these are the basic ingredients now that we're going to use, that we have to have in order to describe what happens around a fold-hop bifurcation. So we'll pick up from here the next time.